afternoon. So I'm wrapping up this section, presenting some very collaborative work in this research. You have the soil scientists, which would be myself, Mark Liebig, and Lee Daniels. We've been working with Rebecca Phillips, who is the trace gas person, and Mark West, who is the statistician and modeler. So this has been some nice work between the ARS up in Mandan, North Dakota, and Virginia Tech. So some background is, in order to really fine-tune climate change models, I feel like we need to really understand gas emissions from an undisturbed soil like a mollisol in North Dakota that much of the year is below freezing, remains frozen much of the year, and goes through really intense thawing processes in the spring. There's a poor understanding of mechanisms contributing to those emissions during thaw as far as soil mechanisms. It seems like when you read through the literature that there are a consistent grouping of variables that are measured and related to the gas emissions. And then there's also this lack of understanding maybe with soil depth. And so in this research we're trying to answer how will microbial emissions of CO2 and N2O vary with temperature increases and decreases with soil depth, and will that response be similar? If so, which of those properties are controlling those emissions? And I think we all know that in the field that if soil would freeze from the top down, there might be some buffering at depth. But in order to isolate these soil properties, we wanted to look at the whole soil profile exposed to the same exact temperature increases and decreases to isolate those soil properties that would influence gas emissions. So our objectives were to quantify how incremental, as in a 5-degree Celsius step, changes in soil temperature affect production of CO2 and N2O at these multiple depths at sub-zero temperatures. And then also determine how the measured soil properties, after we took the gas readings, how did the soil properties that we measured co-vary with CO2 and N2O. And this is a picture of the research site to the left. So the site information, we sampled a typic impacted capital skull with a mollic epipedon to about 40 centimeters. It was from a very small area. It was the swale of this field dominated by little blue stem. Again, this is the site in North Dakota. We collected 6 pairs of cores, which were maybe 30 meters apart. So those pairs were collected within half a meter of each other. And then we sampled 6 different locations along a 30-meter transect. We sampled 280 centimeters. And as we collected these samples, we took them with a press, and we had a plastic sleeve inside so we could maintain the core as it was intact to take back to the lab. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, the soils were collected at 5 degrees C, so that means it was pretty cold outside when we were sampling last October, but the soils were at 5 degrees C. They were maintained at 5 degrees C until the experiment was completed. So in the lab, one of the things that we realized by looking at the literature was that most of these soils are sectioned as when people collect into this depth. The pore connectivity is broken up, the samples are mixed, they're put into incubation jars, and the incubations are completed on mixed samples. So we wanted to keep the whole soil intact, so we inserted them into these PVC sleeves, and we added a surface cap where the soil core was 5 centimeters below the lip of this PVC tube, and put the cap on there with a port to sample, and then we included ports at 15, 30, 45, 60, and 75 centimeters throughout the soil profile. Up here in the right-hand corner, here's a look at the tubing that went into the core. So the cores were kept intact. We pushed those tubes, the tubing with the port attached to it, into the soil core to collect from that the gas accumulation at those depths. So the incubation, this is, I guess, probably the most important part of this talk, is to really understand how we did this. The fluxes in micromoles per hour were measured by increasing and decreasing temperature in 5 degrees C steps. So when I say that, we put the cores in at minus 15 degrees C. We let them sit for a while with the ports open so that they were accumulating and accumulating to minus or acclimating to minus 15 degrees C. Then we closed the ports. We increased the temperature from minus 15 to minus 10. So that was our temperature range. We measured the gases at minus 10, so that would be our T1. So what we were collecting in there was accumulating during that temperature increase, which was very gradual. Cores were flushed between each sampling, and so then meaning that the minus 10 degrees C would become time zero now, and we'd increase it to minus 5 degrees C, which became time one, and then we'd take another reading, flush the cores, backfill with N2, and continue the thawing process. For this, we have 5 active cores. Because we're looking at biogenic emissions, we have 1 autoclaved core in the incubation, and also 1 core in there that we measured temperature on it to make sure that core was actually at these temperatures. So we did 2 sequences. We did a minus 15 to plus 5 thawing sequence, and then from plus 5, we took it back down to minus 15 for a freezing sequence. We measured the gases on a Varian model 3800 GC, equipped with these detectors. This is Rebecca's area. But the fluxes were corrected for the dilution in the airspace from the N2 injections, and which was required for maintaining pressure equilibrium within the core. And then the physical change in moles of gas resulting from each temperature increase were accounted for in our calculations. So here are some figures of what these cores look like as we went through the thawing and the freezing sequence. So the red here is the thaw, the blue the freeze, and the black is our autoclave core. These are just the averages from all those temperature steps to show the separation from zero. So you can see the thawing sequence shows a really nice increase as temperatures go above from minus 15 to plus 5. For freezing, it wasn't quite the same trend. You might expect that as thawing, you'd see this general increase, and then as freezing, you'd see the same kind of trend maybe as the soils go back down. However, it was like once we started decreasing the temperature, the cores resemble that autoclave core. So for the remainder of the talk, I'm just going to be talking about the thaw curve because that was most interesting for CO2 and N2O. We decided, by Mark West's suggestion, to fit some kind of model to these cores because an N of 5 wasn't nearly enough. So here I have the figures of the temperature response of the flux for each depth. So here's 0, 15, 30, 45 centimeters. And I think the interesting thing to take from this, here's CO2 and this one is N2O, is that the temperature response at each of these depths is the same. Across all the cores, we had great reproducibility among the cores. And N2O, you can see the same response, just of a lower magnitude. So our Q10, which is calculated from B in this model, so we fit an exponential model of flux equals AE to the BT. B, this parameter here, which is the temperature response, was the same with depth, so that stayed the same. And A would be our soil parameters that are changing, driving these emissions. So we calculated the Q10s of this, and for CO2 it was 4.76, and for N2O it was 13.07 for the Q10. Here is something that I never get to really see as a soil scientist, but the observed versus predicted values, almost perfect. So you can see that this model is a really excellent fit for these data. So on the bottom is the observed fitted. Really nice line. But this only applied when it was thawing because you could see those temperature response curves previously. So after we did the incubation, we took both sets of cores and cut them into 10 centimeter sections to look at the 0 to 10, 10 to 20, and so on. The properties we measured, this is where some of us come in, are that we used 26 measured parameters in the model, but we had measured many more. We looked at field soil water content. We measure both density for each of those sections, texture, aggregate size distribution. So we had large macro aggregates were 2,000 to 8,000 microns, small macros 250 to 2,000 microns, and micro aggregates, which are 53 to 250 microns. We measured EC and pH, nitrate, ammonium, available P, particulate organic matter weights for the available and slow pools. This was by density fractionation, so it was a physical, not a chemical separation of organic matter pools. What we're considering available would be the organic material between soil aggregates. The slow would be the material within a soil aggregate. We also measured the passive, which would be the chemically bound to the silt and clay fraction. We did carbon and nitrogen on the whole soil, organic matter, and aggregate fractions. And we actually measured root density and length. And these were all parameters selected because we felt like these might be important driving factors for gas emissions. So if you're familiar with the literature in this area, when you look at what people typically consider important variables for gas emissions, a lot of it refers to field soil water content, water-filled pore space, available nitrogen as in nitrate and ammonium, and that these are the driving factors for gas emissions. In our study, these were not the most important variables that we measured for these fluxes. So that was interesting in itself. Our most important parameters were root density and root length. So you can see this curve follows almost perfectly the curve of CO2 and N2O with depth. So here you can see there's not a lot of root mass, but root mass down here or length, but you could definitely, when you cut open the core, you could see that core connectivity and how that would be a really extremely important parameter in gas emissions. Aggregate carbon and nitrogen pools, so here we have the large macro, small macro, and micro aggregate size distributions. So you can see the large macro aggregates decline with depth, which would make sense. The large macros and small macros are created by roots and fungal hyphae. So you can see here, let's see, these are the micro aggregates are fairly high in the mollic epipedon and then decline in the subsoil material. And here are the micro aggregates, or the small macro aggregates, sorry, and they decline also with depth. For carbon and nitrogen, pretty very similar trends. Active, slow, and passive carbon and nitrogen pools. So in the black dot, that's the active. Here's the slow, and the triangles are the passive. So you can see both active and slow pools follow this general trend of decreasing with depth, which is expected. We're now actually giving numbers in megagrams per hectare for an undisturbed mollisol as to how much carbon and nitrogen is in each depth, which is also important. When we looked at how the soil control or soil factors control the fitted parameter A, we didn't use the observed, we used our fitted value from the model because A changed with depth and B stayed the same. So B was the temperature response, it was the same. A are the soil properties that change. We used stepwise and random intercept regression procedures on the fitted parameter A. And what's interesting for CO2 is that these were the parameters that came out to be the most important of the soil properties. So root length was important, clay content, and you can imagine clay would increase as you get past that mollic epipedon. Large macros, active carbon, active nitrogen. When we look at N2O, it's the same thing with root length is obviously very important. Root density comes out to be important, bulk density, large macros. But in this case, it's the slow carbon and nitrogen, so it's the aggregate protected material as opposed to with CO2, it's the stuff between aggregates that's available. So I think that's an incredibly important finding based on most people find, just do whole soil carbon. So now we've got into these different pools and we can say confidently that the active carbon pools and nitrogen pools affect CO2 or most influence CO2 and slow pools in the aggregate protected realm influence N2O. So the mechanisms behind this, we might imagine with root properties that they're extremely important because the exudates stimulate the microbial activity to produce the gases, channels, producing channels for gas transfer, facilitating the aggregate formation in those areas, variable pore sizes, microbial habitats, all these things would go along with the root properties. Active carbon and nitrogen for CO2 is maybe that less specialized microbes are producing CO2, so the fact that they can utilize whatever is free in the soil and at a certain temperature start mineralizing that to produce CO2 is of interest. And the slow carbon and nitrogen for the N2O, this is the aggregate protected material, so maybe they would be assume that they'd be more complex, so maybe more specialized microbes are what's breaking apart the material to produce the N2O. So some conclusions from what we were looking at is that temperature response is not the same for thawing and freezing, and I think that's an important message to take away from this. The first-order exponential equation can be fitted and is suitable for both gases with depth, but we do need to validate this model, and we intend to do that in the next year or so. And then also to keep in mind that the study does represent a very small area, low temperature ranges, and was a short-term incubation. So this was literally something I went up there to do as a visiting scientist and said, okay, let's do some work. I want to learn a new skill, and let's tie all of our expertise together. And we did that with a short-term incubation. So The response to temperature increase was also 3 times greater for N2O than CO2. So temperatures increased from minus 15 to 5. And the differences in the magnitude of the temperature response were likely due to rhizosphere effects rather than the availability of inorganic N as people previously predict. So with that, I would like to take any questions that you may have for me.